If I can thank Peter for bringing us here and for the organisation, a very good organisation. Thank you all for coming, and thank Peter especially for arranging it so that you can have some coffee before you listen to me, so you won't fall asleep. You'll have some caffeine in your brain. I brought some. I didn't bring it up, but I bought some copies of these PowerPoint slides because there may not be enough to go around, so you'll have to share, you'll have to cuddle up close to one another. And this is my title, and I'm particularly concerned to try to put the question of management tools into a wider context, a wider framework, or on a bigger foundation. I think my experience, or experience of myself and my colleagues, has been that you cannot easily have management tools without considering the wider political framework or context. And in particular, I'm going to talk about the research we've done on the involvement of community organisations, associations, voluntary, sometimes professional, sometimes quasi-economic, in regeneration schemes, in two particular cases in England and Italy. That's who I am. And just for further use, the name is Bryn, not Brian. Okay, I know you see, always for Italian people it's difficult. They see, they find that I have to say it. Bryn come Brindisi. Brindisi. Ben said Brindisi, okay. And it's a Welsh name, but I'm not Welsh, so we won't go into that. And I work as involved in a programme of research and teaching which we call Business and Community, which I think, as you will see, shows the increasing interactions between business and community society issues. And I think that will be a main element of my analysis at the University of Bath, which Bath is one of the few UNESCO World Heritage sites in Britain, and it is by common consent a model of Neo-Palladian architecture, and with all the benefits and all the problems that come with that. Okay, so what are the issues in relation to the Corbett scheme, which I'm going to talk about? I'm going to use Remo's paper as the basis for this. And in particular, I want to focus on these points. He lays great emphasis, and the model lays great emphasis upon the centrality of public-private partnerships. And now, as has already been pointed out by Cliff, I think that there's a danger here in focusing only on these partnerships. There's a danger of some partners being more equal than others, business dominating the local public organisations, and there's a danger of disruptive partnerships. And the broader point that I'm trying to make in this presentation is that maybe we should be considering not dual partnerships, the public and the private, the state or the local state and business, but triple partnerships involving civil society representation. And by civil society I mean the informal, semi-formal organisations, semi-professionalised of charities, of voluntary associations, neighbourhood groups, a whole range of these which tend to exist at least in the northern and western societies in Europe. And I also want to ask whether public-private partnerships can be, as Remo suggested, multi-purpose, whether partnerships really are the best model in all cases, and in some cases it may be better to have a single driver rather than a network driver, again because of the relationship to the broader political context of each case. Already the British speakers have referred or hinted at the developing policy framework in Britain, where there's been a move away from unilateral government, where the state, the central state, or its local version presents a command and control model for urban and development planning. The movement has been, as in other areas of government policy in the UK, towards a more of a multilateral governance process in which central government may set some targets or some ultimate objectives, but the detailed objectives and the processes whereby those objectives are achieved is left to negotiation and consultation and interaction amongst businesses, local government, and civil society organisations. Indeed, in the United Kingdom, some of the policies, for example, in this financing of regeneration, argue that, or insist that civil society or community representatives must always be involved in the planning process. This is one of the requirements. The problem here, as emerges, many critics have said in the United Kingdom, is that should this always be the case? Can it always be the case? In many cases, the civil society organisations are weak, they're underdeveloped, and therefore some of these schemes, these regeneration schemes, become confused in their objectives. They're trying both to develop a regeneration plan, but also to build up the capacity to try and bring out and develop civil society and local community organisations where they are weak or non-existent. And therefore there's a confusion of objectives and complications to the process. And of course, civil society organisations aren't always constructive partners in these arrangements. Often they have their own objections or their own agendas, and they may be obstructive. They may make the process more difficult. And as we all know, this is what democracy is about. Democracy is not an easy process. It is always complicated and often difficult. The third issue I want to address is this issue of the driver. Of course, in English, the word driver has two different connotations. One is a force pushing, and the other is, of course, is somebody in the motor car who's along there driving, steering the wheel. And the problem is, of course, you can have a single driver, or you can have a lot of people in the car, and are you going to have some people who are just passengers, who don't have any say in the way things are going? Or you might even have what we call in English the backseat driver. You may not know this word, but you know the concept. You're driving your car, and your wife or your mother or your son or is in the back, and they say, no, go this way, go that way. No, stop, 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 brake, brake, brake. Don't drive so fast. So this is a problem with, if you use the metaphor, we may find with community involvement, we have these backseat drivers. But there may also be cases, perhaps,
you
where...
You can find another word.
Get out and walk, did you say?
You'll find another word.
Find another word, okay. But there may also, of course, be cases, as I shall illustrate this, where the political conditions are such that maybe it is better to have a single agent as a driver, where a network or a team of drivers, it doesn't work. And I'm going to illustrate that with reference to the Naples case. So why participation? Well, participation can be exaggerated. Very often it simply means consultation and involvement rather than influence on decision making. Nevertheless, there's good reasons why there should be participation. Firstly, as we've heard already from previous speakers, regeneration projects are no longer exclusively about economics or about infrastructure. Increasingly, at least in policymakers in North America and the United Kingdom, it's been recognised that to develop or regenerate an area, especially these decaying or imploding, to use Remar's term, urban areas, means attention also has to be paid to developing the health of the citizens welfare facilities, or cultural aspects, as we heard already from Steve, or enhancement of the environment, an aspect that's becoming more and more crucial, and was certainly central in the two cases that we looked at. So regeneration now has to take these other aspects into account for all sorts of reasons. Firstly, there's a danger if it were left to the public, simply public and private partners, that is the state or local state and business, then the interests of citizens and residents in some of these health or welfare issues or environment issues would be neglected. They may even be disadvantaged. Cliff referred to it in his talk about what could happen if North Manchester would simply become a new area for industrial or business development with all those multiple social disadvantages in that area. Government in UK has recognised some of these problems and makes social inclusion also a frequent governmental requirement of regeneration schemes. That is, there should be, if an area is going to be redeveloped economically, it should also try to enhance the social inclusion of disadvantaged groups, provide resources, try to provide employment, educational and health facilities for these disadvantaged groups. So we put these criteria about social inclusion, etc., together with the governance approach, and that means you really do have to have some involvement of the people who are supposed to benefit, the local communities. And as I've said, some UK state-supported schemes actually require community participation. But the questions, of course, have become even more acute then, or more complex and wider. Who should be involved? Who is in this, like, these local communities? Just ordinary individual citizens or representative groups? Are they representative? If so, how many? What form should the consultation and participation take? Should it be simply having a meeting, which is this often being the standard case, inviting some representatives along, telling them what the plans are, inviting some comments, making a few notes and going away and perhaps not really changing anything? Or should it be higher level consultation and involvement at earlier stages in the formation of the plans? And at what level? At neighbourhood level, at a district level, at the city level, in what political forums? Should you create special political forums, or should there be involvement in the official decision-making process? And that's often very difficult for state actors, and even more difficult for businesses perhaps, who are not used to this sort of participation. So we've got a spectrum of involvement, from mere consultation and information on the one hand, through to fuller participation in decision-making at the other. So I turn now to the importance of what I call a political framework. And I think I'm using the term framework in a different sense to the one that Remo has, and perhaps we can discuss this later, and what I call these civil society institutions. The research that I'm drawing most of these ideas from comes from two polar cases, the south of Bristol in the United Kingdom, in the Bagnoli district of Naples in Italy. Bristol we chose as a prime case for this governance model because it had a very vital, well-embedded and numerous network of community associations and representatives. Hundreds of groups, well-organised in federal organising bodies, with a long history of negotiating and often being in conflict with the town, the city planners and the city political representatives. Many studies of UK governance in relation to regeneration had found that the relatively weak community association involvement and relatively weak impacts on the decision-making process with regard to regeneration. This certainly wasn't the case in Bristol. So it was a best case for the model. On the other hand, these institutional networks, the traditions of the groups and their association, and previous lessons that have been drawn, made this a much more complex process and not quite so straightforward and successful. So it was successful in some respects, but made for more complexity in others. Naples, on the other hand, was completely the opposite. It was a polar opposite case. For historic, political and economic reasons, the new administration in Naples in the 1990s decided that it had to exclude civil society and business interests. In the past, these had had a negative impact on development, on planning and construction. There were, if you like, negative alliances between construction firms and civil society groups such as labour representatives aligned to them. And if you go to the centre of Naples, you'll see that there's this whole mix of very poor, speculative, brutalist, modernist construction in the midst of a lot of indigenous and classical architecture. So the council, under the leadership of a new mayor, came up with a plan for the city, the region, the city and the district, and this Bagnoli district, which we could describe as top-down. It was centralised, it presented all the details, and then sought to impose this on this Bagnoli district. Bagnoli was a former steelworks which was planned would be reconverted to a mixture of environmental, small business, touristic, leisure, and environmental resources. But this was done without civil society participation and without public-private partnership. The council were fortunate that they could negotiate the use of the land with the national former nationalised industry that owned the steelworks, and they were fortunate, therefore, in not having any direct economic interests to deal with. Now, despite the similarities in these two cases, both achieved a near consensus on the final uses of the redevelopment sites. This wasn't completely true, because in the situation in Bagnoli and Naples, the exclusion of some of the civil society groups and organisations led to some conflict over two or three particular parts of the site, where there had already been some development for example, a science centre and a social and leisure resource. And of course, in Bristol, there was a long process of conflict and disagreement before the area in South Bristol was finally approved for a mixed-use development of, again, very similar environmental, community, leisure, a little bit of retail, and a health resource, a community hospital. But the important point is that there was no single... Both of these models were quite different, and yet they achieved a similar outcome, which seemed to have a broad measure of consensus. We could talk more about that if necessary later on. As I said, Bristol was only handicapped by the powers of private developers. Unlike Naples, it had to deal with private owners of a large chunk of land, a former factory within the as part of the area for regeneration. And it had no control over this, and this was developed by private industry. Naples, as I've said, was only Bagnoli was only complicated by disputed locations that third sector organisations said, and in fact had already developed within the site.
And that's the reference if you should want for a description of these. Okay.
So, just turning to the network, the governance aspect, the contribution of Bristol's community associations. I've said that there was a dense network of political influence. I've said that they were able to articulate, to represent the concerns and preferences of residents and other interests. If there had been a reliance only on business partnerships, or if they'd been excluded, then these groups would have created severe opposition and obstacles for the plan. As it was, they were involved, and therefore, while disagreeing and conflicting on specific aspects, they were broadly taken along with the process. And consultation sometimes extended beyond mere consultation to participation. They were fortunate in the sense that they had alliances with some of the councillors, the political representatives, but this, whatever the source, this encouraged participation rather than mere consultation. And as I've said, in this case, this instance, the private sector, rather than being able to be involved as a partner, was more of a constraint than the civil society organisation. So I've said already that I think this governance model isn't universalisable because of the example of Naples Bagnoli. In Naples, it would have let in the speculators and their allies. In this instance, the mayor and his administration was capable of acting as a single driver, a unilateral driver, to achieve, ironically, a more generally acceptable plan. And that I've also mentioned that other UK governance cases have not been seen as successful because of community involvement has been artificial or token. It was only possible in Bristol because the politics of the civil society had gradually meshed in with local government politics and planning functions. This is what the point I made about the political foundation being conducive. So I finish then with some broad conclusions and some questions for the Corbyn model. We've already heard from Cliff and the others that competitiveness is perhaps the wrong wrong parameter. That if you focus exclusively on economic competitiveness, you either reduce these other social, environmental and cultural aspects to mere appendages, to mere details. And you may not achieve competitiveness because competitiveness now depends upon a much wider range of social, environmental and cultural factors than simply infrastructural facilities, resources and efficient planning. Businesses shouldn't be the sole vehicles for this process, but also civil society institutions. And we must remember that civil society institutions nowadays comprise a whole spectrum, a whole range, from organisations which are very close to being businesses, they're social enterprises, to full-time professionalised charities, to representative organisations, to environmental organisations, neighbourhood residents associations, a whole spectrum, and all these have to be considered. We call all of this, in the academic jargon, we call all of this civil society spectrum social capital. And if we want to involve social capital in the development for competitiveness or urban enhancement, then we have logically also to involve the owners of the social capital. That is the residents, the community groups and so on. I also want to ask a question whether this means, if we can extrapolate these general points, whether social models that in his paper Ramo refers to as being concerned mainly with regeneration and revitalisation, whether these will always in some way subsume or contain the economic ones, even though there may be an attempt simply to focus on economic development. It may
conflict with and interact with these social models. Just a question, and I have no detailed knowledge of developments in what we usually refer to as Eastern Europe. I think there's a question mark about whether in the East, it's the large cities in the East of Europe and Central Europe, whether they can leap over the trajectory that as the Western cities have followed to this new post-industrial social and governance model, or whether they have to go through some of the same stages. What resources should they try to exploit? For example, labour is much cheaper, should there be an attempt to focus on more short-term, immediate economic development to meet economic problems like that, rather than trying to adopt these more complex models. And I suppose this again is this question about, can we have a single planning model for urban regeneration? And then there's the other problem I've alluded to throughout, that in many cities, even in countries like UK, social capital, civil society institutions are underdeveloped. They aren't always vital, they aren't always strong. And that raises the question of whether something like the Naples approach may be more effective in terms of regeneration objectives. Finally, I would suggest that an all-purpose management model is probably not possible, because the political framework, not just the economic constraints, will contain and often overcome an attempt to apply a universal management model for regeneration. So that's it.